Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. A reminder that we are Zooming on Wednesday, so if something should happen Wednesday night, i.e. the debate, we'll not be discussing it till the end of the week. You know what I do every single day. We've been doing it since March. We start with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. People think, Arnie, you're doing it every day. Aren't you driving them nuts? I'm going, yep, I am. And that's intentional. I want his voice ringing in your ears when you exercise the franchise this November. And many of you have already started to vote. Remember Vindman and vote. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I will be happy to answer your questions.
In the last 2 days, everyone, I have spent more time looking at voting and every angle of voting than I think I've done in the last maybe 2 or 3 months. And maybe it's because as I watch the meltdown in Washington, I realize that the only response, the real response, the only way to send a message in a bottle to Donald Trump and to the GOP and to people who want to undermine and destroy this country is to vote. Yesterday, we actually interviewed a fellow by the name of David Gans, and we're talking about the Roberts Court and what they're doing to really sort of attack voting. Today, I am being joined by someone I have known for decades. His name is Miles Rappaport, and I will go to his bio at the Ash Center. Miles Rappaport, a longtime organizer, policy advocate, and elected official, brings to the Ash Center at Harvard 4 decades of experience working to strengthen democracy and democratic institutions in the United States. Prior to his appointment at the Ash Center, he was most recently president of Common Cause. He headed the Public Policy Center, DEMOS. He was the Connecticut Secretary of State. And when I met him, he was a lowly state legislator. That was in the 1980s. Arnie Arneson and Miles Rappaport were one of the early founders of the Northeast Network of Progressive Elected Officials, where Arnie needed to find the Miles Rappaports of this world because as being sort of this incredibly lonely voice in New Hampshire of being a progressive, I needed to meet other progressives in the Northeast to know that I wasn't crazy, Miles Rappaport. So let me welcome you to the program, and it's just a pleasure to have you back.
Arnie, it's great to be with you, and as it was back in 1984 when we first started our legislative careers. A lot has happened since then.
Miles, you wrote an article with E.J. Dionne, and you have sort of formed an organization to look at voting. But you've decided that rather than sort of work at the fringes to sort of figure out how should we expand the franchise, how should we protect the integrity of vote, who should be voting, all those things that seem to sort of undermine what we ultimately want, which is people to really understand they need to participate in this democracy if they're going to own this democracy and respect the government they elect, is that voting is important. You and EJ have decided to really embrace something I think very important, which is universal voting, that we are all required to actually vote. And when you think about it, Miles, we're required to do a lot of things in this country. Men are required to sign up for the draft. People are required to send their kids to school. People are told that before they go to school, they need to have sort of this regimen of vaccines. I mean, there's all these things that we have to do. As I was thinking about voting, I thought, this is a continuation of something I have believed in since I was 17 years old, and that is universal service. that with rights come responsibilities. And when I was 17, I actually joined Air Force ROTC as the first female class of women, because as I saw my male friends serve in Vietnam, some of them dying, realizing that they were required to register, they were drafted, I kept thinking, what's my role in this? Who am I in this? And this should be a collective decision, not a decision based on gender. And as I looked at this whole idea of universal voting, the best way to approach what's been happening with voter suppression and the Roberts Court and everything else is to make it mandatory. We should all vote. And I think that's just a wonderful celebration of being an American.
Arnie, I totally agree with you. Just let me make two quick points before talking a little bit about the policy itself. One is, I'd add to your list of things that we are required to do, that we are required to serve on juries.
Yes.
And the reason why we do that is to make sure that it is a representative sampling, the jury of your peers who decide on a person's guilt or innocence. The analogy is exact to voting. We want everybody to vote. We want the fully reflective judgment of the entire people of the country. And I think that's why we should do it.
The first time I was called up for a jury, people were upset that I would control this group of 12 people. Okay. They were like, because Arnie's such a dominant personality, how could they put her on a jury? Two things happened. I left and had the most amazing experience of my life. I respected and saw this diversity of people that served on this jury, people that I would normally not hang out with, Miles, but they represented my community. I remember learning from this conservative, you know, Second Amendment guy, because there was an issue dealing with guns. And, you know, my knowledge of guns was pretty limited. His knowledge was pretty intimate. When you brought the 12 of us together and to see the struggle and the exchange of ideas and thoughts and bringing our experience to the table, you were so proud to be part of that jury. And then after we had served, the judge thanked us for our service. I came on the air after that to tell my audience that it was probably the most remarkable experience in my political life. I thought I had sort of seen and touched everything, and then I served on a jury. So I want you to sort of know that I forgot that, but I should never have forgotten that, because I think it was very important and compelling for me to understand why this is such an important institution and one that we all need to participate in.
And you got the benefit of a wide range of opinions, exactly what you're saying. And I think the same should be true in terms of elections. The other thing is, I have worked, as you know, on these kinds of issues for about 35 years. And I have strongly believed in opening up the process, supported same-day registration, early voting, expanded mail-in voting, restoration of voting rights for people with felony convictions, pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds. There's a good suite of policies, and I believe in all of them. I really do. And I think they have made a difference. I think one of the reasons that the 2018 turnout in the midterms was as high as it was, and I'll come back to that, was because people had so many more options for how to register and how to vote. At the same time, we were celebrating that 2018 was a good and high election turnout compared to 2014, but it was 50%, was exactly 50% of the electorate. And that's not something to write home about by any means. So I started to talk to people about, well, okay, if all of this time we've worked on all of these issues and we've moved the needle, but not nearly enough, what can we do to reconceptualize, to transform the discussion and really have everybody have genuinely full participation? And lo and behold, we discovered that in Australia, it has been a requirement of every citizen to vote since 1924. Right. So we're going on 100 years of experience with this in Australia. Australia also gave the United States a secret ballot, which was originally called the Australian ballot when we have it. So we have a history of taking good ideas from Australia. Anyway, they have had close to 90% turnout in every single election. A couple of things. It is a guarantee that the vote is reflective of the population as a whole. And I think that's really important and really important for the United States. Secondly, if everybody is going to vote, then everybody is always listening. I think it changes the nature of campaigns, because you can't just drum up your base and secondarily try to prevent the other people's base from voting, because everybody's going to vote. It tends to make candidates more careful, more, I don't want to say in the center, but at least not alienating other voters because they want to make sure everybody's listening. So I think we should try it. They do it actually, there are 26 countries around the globe that actually do universal civic duty voting. Duty voting is what we're calling it. And I think it's something that we hope to put on the agenda for real discussion in the United States.
I've actually interviewed folks in Australia about this mandatory voting. So I've had this conversation before. So you and I have been on this page, only I didn't realize that I'd be interviewing you in 2020 because you'd be actually sort of offering this up as something we really need to consider and frankly consider now. Part of the reason why I think the idea of this is important is that we've spent the last couple of, I feel like the last decade, fighting the voter suppression that really has been the hallmark, unfortunately, of one side of the political aisle and not the other. And for whatever reason, fearing the voter should tell you that there's something wrong with the democracy because the voter hires and fires. And when you don't want people to vote, you basically don't want to be hired or fired. You actually want to stay in perpetuity. That's not the vision of a democracy. I come from a very libertarian state. I've always said that New Hampshire doesn't believe in big government or big church, okay? We're the least church state in the nation. We, you know, have this huge legislature. We don't fund very much. We're incredibly parsimonious. We don't do taxes, except, of course, property taxes. So I was having a conversation with a libertarian friend. And my libertarian friend, oh, I don't want to do this. It should not be mandatory. This is a right. This is not a requirement, yada, yada, yada. I went back to Australia to sort of take a look at, you know, what happens in Australia, because there are a lot of Aussies that are like my libertarian sort of friends in New Hampshire. They're pretty Wild West too, you know what I mean? I believe there was someone who ran a couple of years ago who understood that they're required to vote, and he just said, go and vote, but just don't check a box. Basically, sort of put your middle finger up, say, I'll show up, but I'm not going to check a box. So I looked at my libertarian friends, and I said, guess what? All they're telling you is show up. If you decide not to vote, that's your privilege. If you decide to walk away, that's your privilege. I think it's stupid. I don't encourage it. But guess what? No one is telling you that you must choose A, B, C, or D. What they're saying is just the way you have to register for the draft, just the way you have to sort of show up for the jury. These are things that you physically show up. If you decide not to check the box, there's no voting police. And the reason I bring this up, Miles, I went to the state of Michigan in 2016. I want to just remind people that we have seen this in the past. In 2016, I believe the number of people who just, now remember, this is a state where Donald Trump won by 0.3% of the vote, a teeny tiny percentage. And people said, well, so many people didn't show up and exercise the franchise. No, 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 no. There were about 80,000 people that actually picked up a ballot and chose neither Hillary nor Trump nor the third party. They were so disgusted that they looked at other places and they could vote for their state rep, but they literally did not check the presidential box. That was double the number from 4 years before. And the reason I mention that is that that's always been an option. What you are saying is let's all show up. When you walk into the vote and you decide to do it, that's between you, your God, if you believe one, and the pencil in your hand.
We had a wonderful working group, the Universal Voting Working Group, that, and I co-chaired it with EJ Dion, who's just a superb journalist and a wonderful human being to boot. We really looked at all of these things. We released our report, which is called Lift Every Voice, The Urgency of Universal Civic Duty Voting. We released it in July. In our recommendations, we actually go further than what they do in Australia, which is we are recommending, obviously, a state that wanted to take this up would have to pass legislation to do it. So it would be up to the state. Recommending that there be a none of the above option on the ballot. We're recommending that there is also a sort of conscientious objection. So the idea here is not to, let's figure out a way to penalize people. The idea is to flip our current culture on its head and make the assumption that everyone is participating. It is a requirement of citizenship, just like the other things that we described. And I think if you did that, you would also have a real transformation of the various institutions and laws about it. If every 18-year-old were required to vote, would schools do more civic education to prepare them to do it? I think they would. If everyone had a duty to vote, do you think employers would be more likely to give them the time off to do so? I think they would. Would legislatures be less likely to pass voter suppression legislation to make it harder? because you're simultaneously requiring people vote and to make it harder for them? No, I think they wouldn't. So I think the whole system gets sort of turned on its head a little bit and make the assumption that we have a culture of full participation. That's what we want to create.
All right, so Miles, hold my hand. I love it. I support it. It's probably been in my DNA my whole life. I can remember I was probably in my mother's womb, like paying attention to voting. And I went into the voting booth with my parents every single time they voted from the time I was a tiny, tiny child. My father talked about
it. You're always ahead of your time, aren't you?
Right. My father, I mean, they developed the voting muscle from before I could vote. You know, they made me understand how important it was from the time I was a child. But I'm the daughter of two teachers. You know, it's not surprising that this was part of an academic exercise, was to understand my level of participation and how it was important for me to begin to understand and to question. Now that you've put this out there, how the H do we make it happen? I am looking at the chaos of 2020. I am looking at the possibility of change in 2021.
Right.
What can we do at a federal level? What can we do at a state level? I'm very frightened about the Roberts Court. It is very anti-voting. We've been looking at just decisions that were made in the last 48 hours that add confusion in South Carolina. I want to not have to worry about that court. I want to have laws. I want to have laws that cannot be manipulated and sort of turned around by a court, either at the state level or at the federal level. So give me the instruction as to what to do.
Okay. Yes, so obviously putting a report out on the table, so to speak, is only the very first step. That the many, a lot of work has to go into it, but we understand that. So there are three sort of prongs of work that we're planning to do over the next year or two. One is to continue to kind of put this out into the public domain. You know, we've got a lot of people who are on the working group and beyond who are writing op-eds and doing interviews like this, thank you. And, you know, really starting to put it into the debate. Secondly, we want organizations who are developing an agenda for the 2021 legislative session, either federally or at the state level, to put this idea into their agenda. So frankly, the NAACP has already endorsed this. It is part of their election platform, which I was really happy to see. The organization Demos, which I used to head, has endorsed it. So we're getting a number of organizations that are beginning to put it into their agenda. And then the third is to go find state legislators and municipal leaders who are willing to get out in front of this and try it. Our goal, to be honest, is in 10 or 12 states next year, this legislation will be introduced. Not to say that it will pass, but at least it'll get introduced. It'll get a public hearing. There'll be some real discussion about it. There certainly will be some real opposition to it, but that's the kind of discussion we want. In my mind, there's a little bit of an analogy actually to the single payer debate, which we're still in the middle of. But for a long time, there's this idea in Canada, and it was working really, really well, and nobody in the United States was talking about it. And then all of a sudden, people started to talk about it. Over time, it became a serious political idea. I'm hoping that that will be the same with universal civic duty voting, that we start to talk about it. I certainly don't expect it to be federal legislation anytime soon. There would have to be a dramatic.
But if there was federal legislation, what could the feds do? Because when we look at elections, we look at it as the province of the states. Frankly, it's not even the province of the states, it's provinces of town clerks. I mean, let's be honest, it's almost, you know, in some ways, I feel like it's like a brave new world, depending on what county you're in, depending on what the clerk is. They seem to be the king or queen of what happens. What could the federal government do, either to support it or to create opportunities for it as it relates, for example, to federal elections, so that you've got this push-pull? I don't want just the states to be doing it. I want to see something happening at the federal level. And if we see a Democratic sweep in 2020, knock on wood, why am I even saying it out loud? I want to know if there's something that could be done in the first 100 days with a Democratic Senate, a Democratic House, and a Democratic president that could really begin the conversation there as we have the conversations happening at the state level.
Right, right. Well, I do think that if there is a Democratic sweep, H.R. 1, which was the bill that the House Democrats introduced last year, which it's a very broad-based, comprehensive piece of legislation, will be high on the agenda. If the federal government were to act on the idea of universal civic duty voting, they could require it for federal elections. Mm-hmm. Now, federal elections are defined by any election in which a federal candidate is on the ballot. The federal government couldn't require every state to do it for every election, although as former Secretary of the State in Connecticut, if the federal government passed something like when I was there, the National Voter Registration Act, you know, the state moved to comply precisely because you don't want to have two systems operating simultaneously and differently in the same election. Right. It's a very strong incentive for the states to do it. So it could come theoretically from the federal government down to the state and municipal level. However, I think it's much more likely that it will bubble up through the laboratories of democracy and the municipalities who are the petri dishes of democracy.
And you mentioned Canada and single payer. And I want to remind my audience that single payer did not pass in Canada as a country. One province experimented with it, then another province experimented with it, then another province experimented with it. And then eventually it became this universal concept of single payer in Canada. You are suggesting is like, again, the petri dishes. Different states are going to begin to sort of embrace it. They may lead on it. They may experiment on it. We're seeing that, for example, with ranked choice voting. We're seeing all these experiments happening exactly in different places. In Minnesota, with public financing of campaigns. I mean, I'll never forget when, you know, Jesse the Body and Mind Ventura became the governor of Minnesota. I was talking to the Secretary of State of Minnesota the day before Jesse wins, all right? This is an incredible story. Oh, there's no way that Jesse was going to win, she thought. But Jesse had enough money as a result of that public financing that he was able to compete with these two very well-known prominent Republicans and Democrats, Coleman and Humphrey, and voila, you got Jesse the Body and Mind Ventura. So people make this assumption that, oh, this means you'll win, or this is a progressive agenda or a liberal agenda. No, it's not. It's an American agenda. It just says participate, get engaged, and then make your decision.
I think we ought to stand or fall. I mean, I think you're right. I don't think this has a necessary partisan cast to it, and it certainly shouldn't. If all of the voters are voting and a decision is made that I think I disagree with, at least I know that this is the genuine view of the majority of people in the United States, okay? Right now we have, you know, in some of the smaller elections, a minority of people voting, maybe two or three candidates on the ballot. And so by the time you get to who won, it can be a third of the people voting. I think consent of the governed, seeking the consent of the governed, EJ says this all the time, really should mean the consent of all the governed. And I think that's the idea that we want to promote here.
I only have a few minutes left. There are two elections, though. There is the primary and there is the general. The problem with the primary is that the primary ultimately is a very, very low turnout. It's usually the extremes of both sides. And sometimes you find out that ultimate candidate, because of gerrymandering and everything else, that becomes the congressperson or whomever, actually only got 6% of the vote as a result of the primary because nobody showed up. And yet because of gerrymandering, ultimately, when it came to November, you had no choice. That was the candidate. Count them on your fingers and toes. As we look at this universal voting, does that only apply to what happens in November? Or is there this understanding that because primaries usually are the venues of parties, that that is a different situation?
And obviously it would be up to the state to make the legislation, but our recommendation is that we do not include primaries in this.
Okay.
That primaries, yes, they're internal party affairs. It's hard to imagine, in my mind, kind of requiring people to vote in a particular party's primary. So our recommendation is that this applies to general elections, and there may be elections that are, you know, small enough so that they don't need to be included or shouldn't be included. That would be up to the state. We have more elections in the United States than anywhere else in the world. So maybe this would be an incentive to consolidate some of them in terms of dates. If this starts to apply in significant elections, it could really catch fire. And I do want to say that municipalities could do this. You probably would need some enabling legislation or home rule legislation from the state. But you can imagine, just to take your Minnesota example, that Minneapolis decides, we really want to do this. All of a sudden, you have 90% of the people in Minneapolis turning out, and the people in the rest of the state say, wait a second, we don't want Minneapolis to govern everything, so let's us do this too. So I think there's a way in which this could catch fire.
You mentioned that the NAACP has endorsed this, that this is part of their platform. And then you just sort of touched on Minneapolis, and of course, I'm thinking of George Floyd. Wouldn't this be one of the wonderful things that could be suggested for Minneapolis as a way to respond to what happened that has been hemorrhaging a community, that has been tearing it apart, is to suggest exactly what you just said. It could start at even a city or a town level and that there could be some enabling legislation, but that one of the responses to what happened is to really say, we want everyone to participate in whatever the decision is, the decision to elect the mayor, the decision to elect the sheriff. We want everyone to know that we want to encourage this kind of participation. That would be a fabulous response to a community that right now is hemorrhaging, one that I bet you they never thought about. But after listening to you for the last 20 minutes, oh my God, it could be the Velcro that begins to pull this community together. And if we see it happening in places like Minneapolis, then a lot of other cities might want to say, let's embrace it too, because we want people to understand this is a place where all are welcome and all participate.
And by the way, I should say that this no individual policy is a panacea, will solve all the problems of our democracy. I still strongly support all of the agenda items that are on their way to this. But if we put this out as a sort of North Star, then I think we'll move our way toward it. So thank you very much for having me.
Miles Rappaport, you're one of my North Stars. So thank you so much for joining us. And we'll get you back again. We will talk about this. We have to talk about it every couple of months. One, to keep it in the conversation. This election doesn't end elections. It just makes us aware of what happened during the election and how we need to repair this too. And if you're worried about what the result is, then maybe you need to make sure that you protect the vote. So Miles Rappaport, thank you so much. And I'm glad that the Ash Center has found you. We'll talk
to you. Thanks, Arnie. I'll come back anytime.
Okay, ciao. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. We will be right back.
Insight Daily Radio. Their names are familiar to anyone who grew up on California rock. Guitarist Danny Kortchmar and Waddy Wachtel. Bassist Leland Sklar and drummer Russ Kunkel contributed to countless albums by James Taylor, Jackson Browne, Linda Ronstadt, among many others. Calling themselves the Immediate Family, the band, which also includes guitarist Steve Postel, will be releasing their debut album, an EP, and singles over the coming months. We spoke with Russ Kunkel about this new project.
It does sound live and fun because it was, we are all in the same room playing together and having a ball. So that definitely came across. You know, nothing compares to five people in a room playing music together. There's no plug-in that recreates that. So, there was nothing but laughs and smiles and giggles the whole time we were doing it. The very first show that we did a bunch of shows out here in California at a place called Bogies, which is a club. And just every time we played it, that we were probably one of the only acts to ever do two shows a night. Because so many people wanted tickets, so we would do one show, they would empty the place and then bring the rest of the people in. And, you know, we were pinching ourselves, just going, are you kidding? We waited this long to do this. You know, we spent our whole careers, our whole lives backing up other people, and now we're doing it for ourselves. And that is the real joy about all this, and we're having the time of our lives.
That's drummer Russ Kunkel on his new band, Immediate Family, whose newest single, Slippin' and Slidin', has just been released on Quarto Valley Records. Insight Daily Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder that we are Zooming this show on Wednesday morning, so this will be before the debate Wednesday night. I've spent a lot of time in the last 2 days talking about voting. And I think the most important antidote to the chaos of this election, to the meltdown in Washington, to in some ways even the response to the pandemic and the sinking economy, is that we have to own change and own a result. And the only way that you can own that is if you can vote. So exercising the franchise is very important. There is one party that is trying to suppress the vote under the claim of fraud and integrity. We have the Roberts Court that is unfortunately also, I think, aiding and abetting the suppressing of the vote. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't become more informed about what is possible and what folks are doing around the country. Joining me right now is Stephen Rosenfeld. He covers national political issues for Alternate, including America's retirement crisis, democracy, and voting rights. The most important thing I know about him is what he does when it comes to voting, because he is the author of an organization called, what is it, Vote? What's the name of the?
Yes, called Voting Booth. It's a project called Voting Booth. The website is votingbooth.media. And basically, I have been covering how people can vote, where they might fall between the cracks.
Right.
You know, will the technology help or hurt the process? It's really complicated this year because voting requires people to pay more attention.
Exactly. And the article that intrigued me, which is why you're on, and then we can go beyond this article, and it's at billmoyers.com, just to let everyone know, is why conservatives attempts to prevent $300 million in election grants from reaching states will fail. After federal inaction, Facebook's founder and his wife stepped in. Now Republicans are suing in three swing states. When I think about voting, I always think about, well, it's the province of the states. You know, it's supported by either the state government or by local communities. We have seen so many stresses on voting this year, in part because of the pandemic. The pandemic is not only draining money from towns and state coffers, but it's requiring us to spend more money in order to make sure that people know that whatever they do, they can do it safely. Well, one of the things they have to do is vote safely. It isn't the same old voting. What we're seeing is, you know, states suddenly deciding to do less in-person voting, more voting by mail, more absentee voting, expanding early voting. There's a whole sort of conga line of changes. But guess what? That requires money, and there isn't money around. So when I think of money and voting, I think of three people now. I think of Arnold Schwarzenegger, I think of Michael Bloomberg, and now I think of Zuckerberg. Talk to me about what these individuals are doing. One, they obviously have access to money. They're very wealthy. But why are they suddenly stepping in and offering cities and towns around the country grants to assist them in the voting process? And then having said that, why do certain groups think they can sue and prevent this?
Okay, well, they're doing different things. What's happening is the big picture is they're stepping in because there's congressional inaction. What happened was when the pandemic first broke, which was mid-March, it was right after the primary that came the week after Super Tuesday, Congress appropriated, I forget, $300 or $400 million. The state said we need billions. And that money was largely spent in the spring and in the summer for those postponed primaries. And what was it spent on? It was spent on all kinds of things like health supplies and postage for people who might not be able to vote in person, but to send them applications and then print those applications and their ballots. And so the thing is, the money ran out. It was largely spent. And just like there hasn't been further aid for people who are out of work or are worried about rent or health insurance extensions, there wasn't any further aid for election administration. And what's happened is when it comes to running elections, it's kind of like a military operation. There's lots of little teeny steps that are pretty boring, but they have to be executed in the right way, in the right order by a lot of people. Everyone talks about a presidential election, but really we're having 10,000 local elections across the country. And those 10,000 local elections are largely going to be run by a million volunteers or low-paid poll workers who are not professionals at this.
Right.
So then you have the officials who have to make sure that all those folks who are doing all that frontline work and in the back office work with handling ballots and handling votes and checking in voters have their supplies to do this. So in the pandemic, there's the need for things like that have never been there before. So certain states, for example, you've heard in the news, people are arguing about, well, is there going to be postage on these envelopes that are going to be returned, which is a big cost. But some states and some counties are making sure they're buying tens of thousands of pens so people can fill out something in person and not have to give the pen back so no one else touches it. I mean, who would think about stuff like this? And then there's all the plastic shields and the personal protective, you know, gear. And then you have, you know, when you kind of move away from like the health side of it into the actual vote counting and ballot processing side, what you've got is, as of yesterday morning, something like 69 million people across the country have requested absentee ballots. That's an astounding number. And it's like 2.7 million in Michigan and 2.4 in Pennsylvania. And even in New Hampshire, where you are, it's 163,000. These are big numbers for these states. So they have to basically ramp up to process them. That processing is not a simple, counting is the simplest part of that process. The most complicated part in which the Republicans have gone to court and have gone crazy over to sort of like resist every intricacy is basically the accepting of the envelope that comes in, because it has to be checked in, just like you, as a, if you go to vote in person, would have to be checked in and accepted. There's new technology that some of these places that have never, ever dealt with stuff on this volume before are doing. So for example, they have to find places to have these counting and acceptance centers. Then they have these machines that are the size of desks that basically are automatic envelope openers. And then you have to have, some places have software programs that are like banking that actually compare signatures with what they have on record. So what's on record? Well, it's what you have on your driver's license or at registration application. And does your envelope look like you signed it the same way? There are a lot of fights about stuff like that. And then you actually get this, the counting, which means things have to be taken out of the envelopes, the ballots, and run through scanners. People have done that before, but they haven't had as many high-speed scanners. So this is the kind of stuff that takes all this money that you're talking about, and this is basically what these wealthy individuals, well, Mark Zuckerberg in particular, is paying for this kind of election infrastructure. Also, the public information that goes out around this, you know, how to vote, you will be safe, do this, here are your deadlines. Bloomberg was mostly trying to help pay the fines for felons in Florida. What's happened there is in 2018, in the upper 60% of the state, almost a supermajority or very close to it, approved this thing called Amendment 4, which restored the voting rights of former felons. There was 1.4 million of them in this state, between 10 and 15% of the state's eligible voters. And the Republican legislature, as it was in many of the places, Arnie, where your show airs, where you have gerrymandered red supermajority, they call trifectas, Republican governors, Republican legislatures, basically came up with laws to prevent those folks from voting. They all were argued on the basis of, you know, security and all kinds of crazy technicalities. It's voter suppression masquerading as technicalities. He raised about $16 million to pay the fines of about, I think it was 30,000 former felons who were willing to vote, or at least that's how I heard about it. And the Republicans, of course, have tried to sue to block that. In that case, we can talk about the crazy arguments they put forth. It's not even as if they want to go to court. They just want to delay it. Right. And then they'll say, oh, yeah, you were right after the election, whatever.
But there's something really evil about Florida, everyone. And I want to just sort of reemphasize what's going on in Florida. So here you had this overwhelming vote in Florida. Over 60% of Floridians said they should be given, they've served their time, they're back in. Part of being returned citizens is that you should be able to participate in exercising the franchise. And everyone thought, okay, it was a slam dunk. And then, of course, the Republicans decided, no, nothing's a slam dunk. And they said, before you can vote, you have to pay off all your fines. The killer, Stephen, this is the part that makes me totally apoplectic, is they don't even know what they owe. That's they don't right. even know what the fines are, everyone. They've got little slips of paper. They have it totally disorganized. So even when you go and say, what do I owe? Now, assuming they may even have the money, which they probably don't, they can't even give you an answer. So in an interesting way, when Bloomberg, and I should let my audience know, I have actually contributed to this group of people who are helping people, that 16 million, I made a contribution, Stephen. I said, I want to help to make sure that they can exercise the franchise if they so choose. I want to help pay off this fine. But what is so awful is not only are they suing to say you can't do this, but the state is actually undermining it, because even if you went in and said, what's my fine, they can't give you an answer. I mean, to me, that's what makes this such a sham.
It's typical of what you're seeing in a lot of the litigation that's out there. There have been more lawsuits about more nuts and boltsy fine points that no one has ever paid attention to before in this election, pushed by Republicans to basically slow down the process, exclude people, exclude and reject ballots. The big picture is it's such an indication of desperation. They're afraid if there was a free and fair election that they would lose these popular vote.
Can we frame it this way? So what Zuckerberg is doing and what Arnold Schwarzenegger is doing with these grants, that they're helping communities because now the pressure is on. Safety is an issue. I just got a message from some folks in my community. I live in Concord, New Hampshire, that they've relocated where you vote. So if you vote in person, in part because of the pandemic, because they want people more spread out, they can't use some of the old physical facilities. Right. They just don't support that kind of concept. So they're relocating voting. Well, how do you know? When did you find out? Who's going to tell you? It goes to the micro level of my little tiny, you know, city of Concord is like rearranging the deck chairs. And the question is, how do you know how to do it? Then here's another problem, Stephen. I think this is important. A lot of people now are voting absentee for the first time ever. They've never done it before. They don't understand the envelope system. They don't know what which one to seal and which one to check. They've never been taught how to do this. And I called my city clerk's office just yesterday, just to let you know. So I wanted to come to this conversation with empirical data, Stephen. And I said, I am watching on my Facebook page and on my Twitter feed, all my friends already voting absentee. Where the hell is my ballot? Okay? Because I know that I requested an absentee ballot for November. So the city clerk says to me, oh, Arnie, we started sending them out in chunks. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. They didn't get all mailed at once. What's your name? Let me tell you where you are and what day it will be sent out. Okay? This is amazing. I gave her my name. She said, yours is being sent out today. Today is Wednesday, everyone. You should get it by Friday. Do you know how much time she is now spending just answering crazy phone calls like Arnie, where she used to be working on dog licenses and she used to be working on property taxes, and now that is physical time and money that is being diverted in order to accommodate this election, which explains in part why they needed money from the feds. And because the feds dropped the ball, these grants are actually very important.
When people say, what can really be done now? If you keep changing the rules, and believe me, there are going to be a lot of rule changes because there are a lot of court decisions that are coming in and the Republicans are appealing everything. We can talk about what their strategies and what they're trying to go to, but basically they're trying to go to the Supreme Court to overrule anything they don't like, to have the authority for these red majority legislatures to step in and say, we write the laws, they're the law, because they're even if they're bad. But apart from that, what people tell me who I really respect as sources and retired lifetime election officials, former secretaries of state, they basically say, all you can really do at this point is public information. And it's not just the logistics around voting that you're talking about. I'm hearing, for example, and I'm looking pretty carefully at this, you're not hearing election officials offer enough assurance about the safety of the process from a COVID standpoint and from an election violence standpoint. Sometimes the people I work for, they take too long to copy edit stuff, and it always makes me cringe because then the New York Times comes up with something that makes a little bit of what I have seem like a fraction outdated. For example, in terms of the logistics you're talking about, people are unfamiliar with voting. It's a habit. If they do it one way, you're used to it. And all of this voting by mail is new. So for example, I was on a call on Monday and people were talking about how in North Carolina, African Americans who are returning absentee ballots, and I think that 1.2 million people in the state, I'm just looking at some numbers here, requested, and about 386,000 have been returned so far. The rejection rate for African Americans is 4 times the rates of whites. Now, why is that?
How would they know? I hate to say it, it's an envelope. It doesn't say this is a black envelope or a white envelope.
I don't exactly know the answer to that, because The thing is, people who are local say that the analytics are there. But they're saying the reason they're being rejected is because North Carolina has a witness requirement where somebody else who is not you has to sign the ballot envelope. And a lot of people are just not doing it.
Right.
Now, that's an example of a voter education thing. Now, how might that happen? Well, if people get together in families, or you can speculate all these things, or churches, or who knows what, and they're doing this all together, and they just do it, and they forget, or who knows what. But it's an unfamiliar process. And that's the kind of thing that we're going to see a lot of. And the question becomes, will it scale?
Let me ask you a question quickly. Remember I mentioned I called my clerk's office to find out when my absentee ballot would be arrived. So she said, it's posting in the mail today. You should get it by Friday. You just mentioned what's happening in North Carolina with so many of these votes being rejected. Now, is this information based on the primary, or is this rejections based on what they see happening for the general
election? This is right now.
Here's my question. Can you get people, or is there a way to find out if someone voted absentee for them to check with their clerk? Did I make a mistake? Was it accepted? Can I rehabilitate my ballot?
Well, this really varies state by state. The answer to that is, it's one of these yes, but, and the but is, it varies state by state. For example, the state of Arizona, which is really important in this, and it's overlooked by a lot of the East Coast media, is it's a swing state that starts counting ballots early and is probably going to go for Biden.
Right.
A court just ordered what they call a cure. If there's a problem for this, they extended the cure period. I've seen federal courts do this. They will, more often than not, come in and order a state to fix a problem that's no fault of the voters if there's no way for the voter to deal with it or give them that option.
Right.
So we saw that in Florida and Georgia in 2018. Federal courts came in and did that. And this notion of information and like public information and reassuring the public, there are some people who are out there basically saying, you know, we're talking to the cops, we're planning for violence. They're not telling you, they're being very terse and, you know, like police-like, but they're not being very reassuring. And the same thing is true when it comes to the COVID precautions. A lot of people right now, because of what's happened with the mail, at least Democrats, and Trump's basically saying, I'm going to declare victory based on the election night, even partial election night results, are trying to vote in person or get their votes in early so they're in that first batch that are counted and reported on election night. But you're not really hearing a lot of officials even talk about what they're actually doing to make it safe from a health standpoint or...
Do you recommend, Stephen? So as I'm listening to you, I totally agree with you. And what I think should be happening is a series of PSA videos on every TV station, on every cable station, on every public access station that basically says, first of all, for an absentee ballot, this is what you need to do. You need to get another signature if it turns out in your state. Then what they need to do is say, this is how we're going to protect you because of COVID, and do almost a mock-up walkthrough so people see and feel assured that if they physically go to vote, they're going to be protected. We know that TV works. We know that, if I hear it one more time about, you know, if you're running a political ad, know why you're running it on this station. Well, you know what? One of the things that maybe Zuckerberg can do, damn it, on Facebook, or maybe one of the things that Bloomberg can do is start running these things that provide the assurance that show people what the process looks like. We learn not just by reading, not just by hearing, but by seeing. So why can't we do the trifecta and have it so that people hear it, see it, and actually understand what they're seeing with their eyes because they actually see it being performed?
I'm in agreement with you on that entirely. You know, this last piece that I wrote, it should be coming out hopefully later today and a bunch of places and tomorrow, was talking about, you know, the voter intimidation in responding to violence. Because I was on this call last Friday, one of the top FBI guys was saying that all these white power groups are really amped up because Trump is basically saying, you know, encouraging them to meddle. So the question is, where are they going to do it? And what's the response going to be? And what ends up happening is when you really get into this, there's going to be 100, maybe 120,000 polling places open on election day. And so they're not going to be picking them out randomly. They're going to go to the places where there have been Black Lives Matter.
What are they going to do? I mean, they're going to shoot people. I understand intimidation. I've been intimidated my whole life because I've been a politician. Trust me, people have like come up to my face. Here's my question. If I am voting early and I'm voting absentee, I'm available on election day. Should you send me to Detroit? Should you send me to some state? And I will walk with them. I will pair with them. I will protect them, just the way I used to do it at abortion clinics, where I would make sure I would protect people getting an abortion. I am prepared to deal with intimidation. What should we do to make sure that their intimidation won't work?
You should not engage in what becomes arguments and fights.
Right, no verbal conversation.
Because you're there to vote. You're not there to fight.
Right, you're there to vote. Focus.
So then the thing that you should do, you should document everything and share that with all these election protection groups, because they will then be able to put it out on social media for the media and also go into court and stuff like that. Now, what's really tricky about this, Arnie, is that, you mentioned abortion clinics. That's really important because every state has these buffer zones, but the laws really, really, really vary. I mean, in New Hampshire, you can follow a voter inside and keep, hectoring them as long as they have a 10-foot wide corridor. Most other states, it's a 100-foot barrier. That's like where the electioneering or the advocacy on behalf of a candidate or a cause has to stop. Pennsylvania, it's only 10 feet from that door. The reason we saw that thing in Fairfax County was it's 40 feet. Election officials have certain authorities in law to maintain order in their facilities. So they can tell people who are like challengers or partisan observers to shut up, being blunt, behave, or you're out of here. But when you move outside and go past those buffer zone lines, you're really talking about law enforcement. It's local police and sheriffs. You know, in a lot of these communities that have had these anti-police brutality protests, which is where people think, the white supremacist groups are going to go in, they don't trust the cops for a lot of reasons. And people are trying to negotiate ground rules. And the question becomes, well, what do you do? What's acceptable? So for example, what would be acceptable would be saying, if you see a sheriff or a police officer directing traffic into a parking lot, that's okay.
Do me a favor, write a piece about the buffering. I did not know that about New Hampshire, for example.
I think that
we need to know that in order to empower those of us locally who want to aid and abet. And of course, here's the problem too. It is a pandemic. Social distancing or physical distancing is also something. And the people that might be hectoring these people probably won't be wearing masks. So you've got both the concern about the buffering and the intimidation, and then you've got the concern that you can't order them. In my state, it is not a law. You cannot order them to wear masks. So they will be walking around maskless, potentially, as well as threatening, potentially. So this adds another wrinkle to this. I need to let you go, Steve Rosenfeld. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm so glad you have this thing called Voting Booth, and we will make sure that we follow it and send me your stuff so I can share it with many people.
Thank you so much. We'll be back.
All right, ciao. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow. Stay well, stay healthy. You better-